Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Thanks, Robin, and welcome, everyone. It's great to have you with us. Today's event, as you know, is going to focus on innovative market solutions to confront climate change, although we'll probably work our way around that topic in various ways. It is very much part of LSE Environment Week, as Robin mentioned. And if you want the full program, you can find it online. Just search for LSE Environment Week and you'll find the full program. I'm Jonathan Leap. I'm the Executive Director of the International Growth Center, and we're very pleased to be one of the sort of co-hosts of Environment Week and to be hosting this lecture tonight. Let me just say a few housekeeping things about the lecture. It is being live-streamed to our international audiences, and we have a lot of people joining online from all over. We're also recording this session so that we can make videos available afterwards. It'll be available both on our site at IGC, but also on the LSE site. We will have a time at the end of the presentation and the panel discussion for questions from you and from our online audience. So as we're going through, do keep track of the questions you might like to ask, and I'll do that towards the end. And as I said, we'll be pulling in our online audience as well. If you're so inclined, please feel free to contribute online as well using the hashtag LSE Environment Week. Now, in terms of the background for this event, it really starts from the recognition that developing countries are, in a sense, the epicenter of the climate crisis. As we argued in our IGC white paper, developing countries are the most vulnerable and are where the costs, the damages of climate change are most highly concentrated. They are also the countries that are the highest emitters of the future if we don't do something now. And then they're also the countries where growth is most needed to raise living standards and eliminate poverty. Estimates of the investment of just the magnitude of funds necessary to enable developing countries to make this transition range from somewhere between $1 and $4 trillion a year between now and 2030 as a starting point. And of course, as you, I'm sure, know, only a fraction of that funding has so far been made available. So there's a massive funding gap in terms of what's needed to enable developing countries to make the transition, both in terms of the resilience they need to survive the climate shocks and in terms of reducing, moving to a lower carbon trajectory to reduce their future emissions. And at the very same time, the world is far short of meeting its global targets as set out in Paris and elsewhere. So what's, I think, so important and exciting about our topic tonight is that we're going to be talking about mechanisms that can address both of these things simultaneously, that can help to get us more on track or closer to on track with the global emissions trajectories we need to limit warming, and at the same time provide funding to enable developing countries to make the critical transition to becoming more resilient and lower carbon in terms of their future growth. Well, we have a great panel to discuss this with us tonight. We have, working from the forest chair, we have Bashaku Demis, who is with the IFC. She's the carbon finance lead from the IFC, and as you know, the IFC, a very big player internationally in this space. We have Claudio Frischtak, and he's our IGC country director in Mozambique. Mozambique is, I'm sure you know, one of the very poorest countries in the world, and yet perhaps the country most affected by climate change. We have Ambassador Ali Safraz Hussain, who is the Pakistan ambassador to the WTO. And then finally, very pleased to have Professor Rohini Pandey, who is the Henry J. Heinz Professor of Economics at Yale University and director of the Economic Growth Center there. So I want first to welcome Rohini and ask her to launch our discussion today with a short presentation.
Thank you, Jonathan. And let me start by congratulating the organizers of Environment Week, starting with Robin Burgess. It's very inspiring to see how over the last couple of years, LSE has really come to the center stage as a place where you come together to discuss not just environment research, but also its links with policy. And through IGC, I think it's a very natural connection, which all of us saw yesterday, we're thinking about how these research findings can move into policy. And so I hope we'll be able to have a similar discussion today. And with apologies to those who heard a version of this yesterday already, I'm going to start by just giving a brief 10 to 15 minute talk on the question of the role of carbon markets. And in two parts, often when we think about markets, we think of that as the antithesis of anything to do with addressing environmental or climate change issues. So we would typically think that something like a voluntary carbon market or any carbon market is going to be a bad thing when it comes to carbon. What I want to argue today is exactly the opposite, that if we think about it well, a voluntary a carbon market, which includes in it aspects of right now what comes in a voluntary carbon market, can both facilitate equitable transfers to the global south and possibly help meet Paris Agreement targets. So that's an optimistic sort of description. So now I'm going to step back and in some ways start with the bad news that we need to confront. So I'm sure many of you in this room have seen some version of this graph. So just as a reminder, one of the key features of the Paris Agreement was the idea that if we want to keep global warming, ideally to below 1.5 degrees centigrade, as a world we need to move to net zero by 2050. What this meant is that by 2050, any additional emissions going into the atmosphere should be accounted for by either reductions in emissions of the same amount. So now when we look at where we are, and there are many such trackers, what we see is the way global greenhouse gas emissions need to fall to be 1.5 degrees centigrade consistent, which is this bottom green line, is very far off from where we are right now, which is given the current set of policies and actions where we are. We can try to be more optimistic by thinking about what if we go beyond policies and actions to actually thinking about targets or including what are right now pledges or, you know, and create more optimistic scenarios. Things improve, but we're still well off the target. And one of the things we see in the data is that most of the pledges and targets that we see currently are being set by rich countries. And that is an important reason for that. If you are a low-income country, historically, you have not contributed very much to emissions. Development is extremely important. Reducing poverty is extremely important. And so to commit to a net zero target or to commit to reduce greenhouse gases may often seem as being against the path of development. So the first question you could ask is, well, maybe we shouldn't tax low-income countries at all. What if we just scale up the kind of carbon pricing policies that are occurring in rich countries? Well, if you look at the numbers, it's unlikely to be enough. So just currently, the domestic carbon pricing that we see across the world accounts for something like 6% of emissions. There's been a lot of progress in compliance markets, but it's still quite small. China is going to hopefully join, and we'll see a big bump up from it. But just focusing on scaling up domestic policies in rich countries is unlikely to be sufficient, especially when we see some of the large emitters in the future are probably going to be countries like China and India and other countries that deserve to grow and deserve to seek to provide their citizens the quality of life that we see in the rich world. So what's the way forward? A lot of the discussion therefore started focusing on how do you actually have mechanisms wherein we see financing or transfers to lower income countries in order to reach these emission targets. And when we think about what we're trying to do in these countries, you could either be trying to reduce existing emissions, which is, for instance, cut industrial production or change the kind of source of energy being used, or you could try to think of working on the margin of what we would call avoided emissions. And a key part of avoided emissions that we see, especially in low-income countries, comes from preventing deforestation. So just as a reminder, every year, tropical deforestation emits 4.5 times as much as aviation and shipping combined. Every year, right now, we are deforesting area equivalent to the land mass of South Korea. And figuring out ways to swiftly reduce deforestation is, of course, extremely important for other things we care about, like biodiversity, but it's also critical for hitting the 1.5 or 2 degree target. It's also the case that, you know, avoiding deforestation emissions in low-income countries is likely to be a relatively cheap form of abatement. That's both good and bad news. It's good news because for any fixed climate budget, you want to first reduce the cheapest emissions that are the cheapest to reduce, because all greenhouse gases matter. At the same time, we have to be careful that we don't end up with a bad deal for low-income countries where, you know, just because they have the cheapest emissions, they end up selling, say, land to not be deforested in a way that harms them in development. And so that's why I think in thinking about how you want to set these pricing mechanisms, it's going to be important to think about what is an equitable price. So when we think about development, we often think about energy use. So you have a lot of discussion about how there is no rich country in the world that is not energy intensive. What I think is also true is that changing land use or deforestation is also a critical part of the growth trajectory of many countries. So what this graph shows you, and I recommend looking, it's a very nice paper, it basically compares boundaries of countries and looks at, say, two countries, one of which they border each other, one is richer, one is poorer, and looks to see what is the difference in deforestation just across the border of a richer versus a poorer country, and uses that to get a prediction of how much forest cover will be lost with development happens. And so this is a version of what we would call the environmental Kuznet curve. This shows you that, you know, countries that have very large forest cover right now, for instance, Sierra Leone, DRC, other such countries, are right in the region where we should expect, without transfers, development itself is going to lead to them to increase land use and to move towards deforestation. So another way of talking about this is to say that perhaps going ahead, we think about energy use as an important part of the industrial process. We should start thinking about changes in land use similarly. And just as we talk about right now with renewables, how we want to change energy use patterns, we need to start thinking about what are we going to do that is going to allow countries a chance to develop but change land use patterns in these countries. So what have countries been thinking about this? Well, in COP26, there was an attempt to operationalize this Paris Agreement, Article 6.4, which was to create a UN-governed carbon credit market through which these emission reductions or removals could be transferred internationally. However, these discussions are currently stalled, and they're unlikely to be resolved in Azerbaijan at COP29. So what is the market we are left with if we want to have, say, a rich country government or even a tech company like Amazon or Meta that has, you know, hugely energy-intensive data centers, wants to go net zero and wants to do so by reducing deforestation in, let's say, the Amazon? What is the mechanism it would use? So right now the main mechanism is going to be what's known as the voluntary carbon market. Currently the voluntary carbon market is very small. It has only around 0.2% of global emissions. But it has the potential, if it succeeds in actually bringing in nature-based projects, to be quite large. If you look at the top market companies that are using what we would call RED plus or reducing deforestation projects to reach the net zero goal, 50% of the so-called offsets are coming from forest protection projects. And just to remind you what a carbon offset project is or how you do this, this is how many of you will have seen examples of this. So just to take the one in the corner, when I buy a flight ticket, you know, I get a little ping saying, do you want to offset the emissions cost of another flight? So for instance, when I came here, you know, I have a number of hours of flight. I put in 10 hours. I was told I would be contributing 1.89 tons of emissions. And what was surprising is it's pretty cheap, right? So for $31, I can apparently undo the damage that my flight is going to do to the world. And you're right to be skeptical when you look at this number and say, that's very unlikely. That doesn't sound to me like what I've heard as the social cost of carbon. And indeed, that captures the fact that the voluntary carbon market is not doing a good job of pricing carbon. So what happened in the voluntary carbon market? So what we see is up till around 2021, there was a huge boom in this market. It grew fast. And while it was still small, if you just looked at that growth pattern, you would think that by 2030 or 2040, this would be a substantial share of emissions. However, what we saw very soon after was a crash. So this is from a title of a New Yorker piece. We're talking about the great cash for carbon hustle. And what we saw post-2021, this is the S&P Global Index of prices in this market. The dark blue line is nature-based carbon credits, so that would capture the kind of land use of forest projects we're talking about. There was first a stagnation in demand in starting 2022, so demand fell. And then it was followed by a series of newspaper and science articles suggesting that the basis on which our carbon projects were being sold was false. So before I come to what went wrong, let me just define a term, which is what are we trying to achieve when I buy an offset? What do I try to achieve when I pay $31 to offset my emissions? I hope to pay to a project that would not have happened without that money. So what this means is that a carbon reduction project is additional only if those removals would not have happened without that money. Now suppose the project I end up paying for is actually to a set of farmers who had no intention of deforesting their land. So this is just, you know, money they're happy to have. It doesn't change their activities. In that case, the carbon reduction project is non-additional. And a lot of the revelations in this 2023 were that a lot of these projects were non-additional. And you can see how that happens. The cheapest projects are going to be projects provided by those who don't need to change their behavior. And so one of the reasons you're seeing such low prices in this market is because several of the projects are non-additional. What's also important to realize is you might think, well, you know, there's some mistargeting. Mistargeting happens all the time. We hear about it with poverty programs. The reason why this is worse is because it's not just giving money to a farmer and not changing her behavior. I'm actually presuming that I have changed her behavior and using that to continue to emit, right? So in some ways, the total amount of emissions have actually perhaps gone up more than they should have because I thought I had offset my emissions, but actually I had not. So the offset market, if it exists and is full of non-additional projects, it may actually, rather than reduce emissions, contribute to keeping it at the same level or potentially even increasing it. The other thing we see is reflecting this fact that there's a lot of uncertainty about which type of project has how much additionality, a lot of differences in prices. So what's the kind of project you're very certain is going to actually be additional? It's probably kind of a carbon sequestration project in Norway where you're extracting carbon from the atmosphere. That's also a very expensive project. And you see that in the price. And so, you know, one response is, well, maybe that's where we should go. We should only focus on these kind of carbon removal projects and not consider things like forestation projects. And I come back to that. But it's interesting that this is actually something that has moved into the policy space, right? So the current plans for Paris 6.4 suggest that they will only allow emission reductions. So that would be, for instance, reforestation projects or carbon sequestration where you're extracting carbon from the air, but not avoided emissions. And so, for instance, the UK submitted to the UN process a submission stating that it is the first part we would completely agree with, that it is vital that 6.4 delivers real, measurable, and additional reductions and removals. And given this, it argued that we should not consider deforestation projects. What I would suggest is that a lot of problems that are hitting the deforestation market are probably going to hit a reforestation market or a wind farm market as well. So in some ways, trying to deal with the problem by simply removing deforestation is both not going to solve the problem at hand, plus it's actually going to remove an extremely important potential source of revenue for international climate financing to reach low-income countries. So let's return to why do I say that? Well, a lot of the reasons these low-quality projects are currently entering the market is not just because, you know, someone has an incentive to enter. Well, there are always people who have the wrong incentives to enter. You could ask why are they not getting screened out. And in this particular case, a lot of reason why they're not getting screened out, because there's a significant conflict of interest in terms of who is verifying a project to say whether it's additional. In particular, in the current system, typically the verifiers or auditors are paid for by the brokers or the registry, or people who actually benefit from just selling more emissions. So first reason you're seeing this problem is just is that we just have a poor screening mechanism. And another is that exposed, if I'm sitting in a rich country, it's very hard to monitor whether a forestry project is being implemented well. It's also hard to just implement projects in lots of ways, of getting money to the place, to ensuring that people are getting paid on time, for instance. And that's going to affect reforestation as much as it's going to affect deforestation. And so a lot of what I've been working on is to try and think about that let's start trying to work on resolving some of the supply side issues that are going to be critical in ensuring that we get high quality credits. I know I'm running out of time, so I'll kind of go a bit faster through this, and happy to go back to this in the Q&A. So first of all, it's important to see that there are projects that work. There are payment for ecosystem services that are additional. We have colleagues who have conducted large field experiments, which are similar to clinical trials, or how you would test for, say, the quality of medicine, and show that if you take large enough areas of land and provide enough money, you will actually crowd in forest areas that would have been deforested without the money. So it's not as if every project that enters the market is non-additional. A lot of it is you need to pay enough to make it worthwhile for someone on the margin of deforesting to not deforest. I'd also say that it's important to see that that low-income countries are pushing back against this removal of removing deforestation. Philippines, for instance, has been a major proponent of including avoided emissions. They have talked about this. So what my proposal is that let's take the voluntary carbon market and start trying to use it as a sandbox to look at regulatory changes. One of the reasons for saying this is that we do have a set of what we would call good buyers, very interested in this market, which are largely, I'd say, tech companies. So if you look at the voluntary market, some of the bigger players are Amazon, are Meta, are Google. They are looking to support nature-based projects in lower-income countries. They're looking to come up with principles like, say, additionality, but have not yet identified what that means concretely in terms of implementation. And, you know, as Robin and Jonathan support a lot of development economists whose bread and butter is to really try to get evidence on these issues. So you want to, for instance, remove the conflict of interest. We have evidence from research showing that if you do things like have certified verifiers and assign them randomly rather than letting firms choose them, you can avoid the conflict of interest. We can deploy standardized digital monitoring technology to try to look at ex post implementation. And we can use program standards that calculate project additionality much better than is being done right now. Right now, quantitative scientists and social scientists are actually not involved in these discussions. And a lot of this is trying to get to a place where we are part of that conversation. So let me stop here. Thank you very much. And I'll open questions now.
Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Okay, first I want to turn to Ambassador Hussein. Pakistan, as many of you will know, has been at the forefront of advocating for climate justice, especially following the devastating floods in Sindh province. So the question is, how can Pakistan leverage international platforms and negotiations and opportunities created by carbon markets and others to secure more predictable and equitable climate finance, and including sort of the whole landscape as you understand it?
Thank you very much, Jonathan. First of all, I would like to congratulate LSE on holding the Environment Week, bringing together academia and policymakers. The Loss and Damage Fund was established subsequent to the floods in Pakistan, and it was considered a big diplomatic global win for the Global South. However, the way Loss and Damage Fund has performed, or rather has not performed since then, has not been very encouraging. Just to put into perspective some of the funding requirements that Pakistan has, and it is estimated that we need to spend around 10% of our GDP annually for the next 7 years to reach our goals for 2030. Now, that kind of money is not available in the country. And given Pakistan is currently in the IMF program and not us, there are about 56 to 57 countries which are highly indebted at this point, are facing climate crisis, don't have the resources. And I don't think in the short term they will have the kind of the macroeconomic stability that's required for the private capital to come in. Now, this is a challenge because if you look at the report of the Climate Policy Institute, more than 80% of financing in 2021-22, about $1.27 trillion in total, which went into environment, came actually from private sector. So it was seeking returns and commercial returns, and only about 4 to 5% was very concessional, grant-based financing. So what we need to do in this scenario? The first thing is that we need to continue diplomacy at multilateral forums, whether it's the World Bank, whether it's the WTO, WIPO, and others, constantly bringing out the commitment that was made under the Paris Agreement with respect to the funding commitments by those who have actually contributed to the problem since the Industrial Revolution. It's not countries like Pakistan who have contributed in less than 1% in total emissions, but are among the 10 most affected. We have not caused this problem. So that's a key point that we need to continue to bring, and we do continue to bring it in every forum. The second is that we need to bring coherence across different international bodies. So what UNFCCC is saying, what WTO is saying, what IMF is saying, or what World Bank is saying, they need to talk the same language. In Pakistan, whatever little funding we have available from our budget resources, we can't spend it on environmentally sound technologies because of the IMF program. The third thing that we need to do is, we need to, and not just Pakistan, I think other developing countries, we need to stop looking at grant-based financing. That would be very, very difficult. We need to rely on ourselves. That's the bottom line. And relying on ourselves means that we need to make funding available, which makes it attractive enough for private sector to invest. So setting up a risk guarantee funds, which we have been advocating, first loss provisions, bringing in financial structures which make it viable for the private sector to invest. We need to start working more regionally and looking at South-South cooperation. We don't see that the commitments that have been made in the Paris Agreement are going to be fulfilled by the developed countries. It's very unlikely that they will do so. And finally, what we need to do is that we need to work with those funds, and we need to build our capacity as well to put together bankable projects. That's an area, I think, where the technical capacity and support can help and is available as well to put together bankable projects. So I'll stop here.
I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about some of Pakistan's adaptation initiatives already. So there's the 10 billion tree tsunami program and others you may want to mention, and whether there's a way in which some of those initiatives can be integrated into some of the things Rohini was talking about in terms of using those as mechanisms to generate international finance.
Absolutely. I think we don't have, and we looked at the presentation with interest, we don't have a compliance carbon market. It's complex, it's difficult to set up. We don't even have a voluntary carbon market in the country, but it gives an opportunity. The reason it gives an opportunity is because we can put in a structure where these carbon markets are set up. Generally, the pricing of a carbon offset, as opposed to a ETS, which would be a compliance-based market, generally the prices in a voluntary carbon market are lower for the same CO2 equivalent, ton equivalent. We have the opportunity with respect to the billion tree tsunami. And also there are projects currently being undertaken. There's the Delta Blue Project 1 and Delta 2 Project 2, which are mangrove projects in the province of Sindh, where we have been able to successfully implement these projects. And Pakistan has a potential of roughly $300 to $500 million per year. It could be a good revenue stream of foreign exchange and could give the required macroeconomic stability. However, the challenge that we have is that the environment policy is fragmented at various levels of the government. While the implementation is done at the provincial level, a number of responsibilities are at the federal level. So one thing that we need to do is federalize this. The second is there has been a rather unique development in the country in the last year. Pakistan imported $3.5 billion worth of solar panels. And it was not driven by a sudden love of environment by the people of Pakistan. It was actually driven by the very high energy costs. So the market drove people. And unfortunately, we have the government has a perverse incentive that that money is not spent on the solar panels, because the more people use solar energy, the lesser they will use the grid-based energy. And the public sector power and energy projects currently and the agreements are structured in a way that we have to continue to make certain capacity-based payments. So the moment the grid-based consumption reduces, your per unit price really goes up, which means the government has to spend more because those are backed by the government guarantee. So that is the challenge that we face. Now, why we got into those projects is a separate question. It's debated. Some of the academics from some of very good international schools actually question, why at that point 30 years ago we didn't have the foresight what's going to happen 30 years from, at that point in time, and those projects were actually negotiated and finalized. And then we need to have innovative structures for local finance. There's a lot of private sector money available within the country which can be mobilized through debt equity swaps. We have launched carbon bonds in the local market, which are local currency based bonds, which will be used particularly for environment projects. And then the central bank has issued regulations around environmental risks. But it's critical that we set up the voluntary carbon markets. Difficult to do a compliance carbon market in the country, but this market can really offer an opportunity to trade carbon offsets.
Thanks very much. I think this example of how, that many of you may have seen in a story in the FT last week maybe, that when it's rich households who are buying solar panels, then that's depriving the utility of customers who pay unsubsidized rates. And so it has a disproportionate impact on their revenue, and we've seen the same thing in South Africa as well. Claudio Frischak, who's our country director in Mozambique. What if I could just start by picking up on a point Ali made, which is this tension between national and local. And it's something we talked about earlier today. So I wonder if you could say something about how, some of the challenges around climate finance, whether these are the sort of voluntary carbon markets or other things, and how most of that's focused on the national level, whereas so often we see climate challenges at the local level. And then I want to come back to a question of the CBAM and some of the other questions first. Okay. But if we could start with that national-local tension.
Well, first of all, it's a pleasure being here, and thank you so much for the invitation. It's also fantastic that the involvement of LSE students and faculty and on issues of climate change. This is just a very quick parenthesis. Obviously, I think we all know, and Dr. Ruini just shown us, that we're on the wrong track. I don't think it's been extremely unlikely, not impossible, extremely unlikely that we'll reach 1.5 degrees. It's more likely, unhappily, that we're going to be in the 2.53 degrees range, which I think would be quasi-catastrophic for all of us, but mainly for the younger generation. So I'm just saying this is not, I don't want a positive message, but the fact is, let's say, objective message, is a realistic message. There's an enormous problem with collective action, and we have not been able to resolve it. Sorry, this does not exactly address this, but it's just a preamble. In many of our countries, the countries the IGC works, there is a bit of a tension between local authorities and central authorities, between cities and central governments. It is a fact that cities, they are the centers of innovation, where information flows, and it's also a fact that people that live in cities generally are more well-informed, it's an objective fact, than people that don't live in cities. And therefore, many governments face the following conundrum. Parties or governments that have been, parties, let's say, been established for a long time, which are originally rural-based, they're now being challenged by the younger generation, a lot of it which is city-based. And as one of the corollaries of this is this tension of resources. Where should resources go to? In particular, most of the resources historically have been mobilized by central government. And there's no question of allocation, particularly because the tax base is narrow for many of the earlier of the poorest countries. In Mozambique, for example, per capita income is $525, just to have a sense of what we're talking about. Bit different than Pakistan, which is a far more sophisticated country with lots of human capital. Its human capital is scarce, you know, it's faces you know, significant institutional challenges. But the point is, for $525, we know, you know, from the old developing economics tax and also the new developing economics tax, the tax base is still very narrow. And as a result, there is this fight. The question is, and the problem is that it is at the cities, at the provincial level, but at the cities, that most of the action, environmental-related actions, take place. In particular, if you talk about climate-related extreme events, you know, typhoons and so forth, in Mozambique, the cities which are the cities are the ones, particularly coastal cities, are the ones that are first hit by floods and then also by drought. And as a result, there is a tremendous pressure on cities' finance to provide services, but not only to provide services, given there's a tremendous unknown, a large number of IDPs, internally displaced people, many of weather-related. Those people have to be, they come to the cities, and the cities have to respond on the labor market side, finding jobs, gainful jobs for them, but also, on the other hand, providing services. So there's this tension, and I think this is not only in Mozambique, but in many of our countries, this continuous tension of scarce resources and so forth. Within this context, unhappily, and I like to use an old expression, many of the, maybe the older generation will find, countries, and I think this has already been said here, countries have to lift themselves up from their bootstraps. That does not mean that they should refuse support, external support. To the contrary, that does not mean they should refuse. You know, but if at the end of the day, it's by pulling themselves from their bootstraps that development will come.
So, can we shift gears?
Yes.
I really want to give you a chance to talk about CBAM because that's a big issue for Mozambique. Can we do that? So, as many of you know, the European Union has established several different policies which are really aimed primarily at shifting the focus of their targets from production to consumption, right? So they want to tax the carbon content of consumption within the EU as opposed to production. The problem with taxing production is that your industries can go move out and then be able to import without those taxes. So it's a sensible motivation, and that's led to two different policies more, but one is deforestation related, and that is that anyone exporting to the EU will have to certify in great detail that the products do not involve any deforestation. The second is something called CBAM, which is the border adjustment. What's the C?
Carbon
border adjustment mechanism. And that is saying that if the exporting jurisdiction, Mozambique, does not have a price for carbon, then the EU will levy a substitute tariff on that import into the EU to reflect the carbon content. Now, in contrast to the voluntary carbon markets that Rohini was talking about, which have the potential to be a win-win for the global north and global south, these sorts of policies, while well motivated from the EU perspective, are win-loses because they're imposing tariffs effectively and higher costs and compliance costs, potentially considerable compliance costs, on the developing countries. So Mozambique is a big aluminium exporter, you might not know, and so will be affected by these new CBAM things. And I wonder if you could talk to us a bit about how the government is responding, and also perhaps about the research policy partnership that's sort of helping that.
Okay, well, the first point is that governments in general are taking the climate-related issues very seriously, all of them. Okay, that might not have been the case 5 years ago, 8 years ago, but right now, quasi-irrespective of the level of income, the level of sophistication, people are paying attention. So that's the case of Mozambique. Particularly, what they did is they set up within the Ministry of Economy and Finance a climate finance unit. So this climate finance unit is entitled, the fundamental function is put everyone on the same page, everyone meaning all the government institutions and also non-government institutions on the same policy page, and second, inform the design of policy. Now, on this issue that Jonathan just mentioned, there is this peculiarity. Mozambique is a significant exporter of aluminum. Aluminum, at the end of the day, 70% of which is energy. So that's it. For historical reasons. And it's actually a very efficient producer of aluminum, incidentally. And it's going to be facing a tax, a border tax adjustment to export. And basically most of its aluminum is exported to the EU, quasi 100%. So that's an incredible case, which is also a very illuminating case of what can be done. So the government has a unit. So we have a counterpart. The IGC in this case. So we have a counterpart, but that's not enough. I think it's important, and governments are paying attention not only to the fact, but also to evidence. Say, what can be done that makes sense, that makes scientific sense, makes economic sense? And what we've been able to do with, with a tremendous support from an incredibly high-powered team, is to provide a paper, discuss with the government in a systematic and very systematic way, what are the options for Mozambique. And at the end of the day, there are fundamentally three options. Okay, let the EU tax, and so you don't do anything, but then they tax. Or at the end of the day, you just directly tax the company, and you say, well, the immediate response from the government is, well, if I'm going to be taxed, I tax as opposed to the EU tax, which is kind of a, no, of course, if you say, but if you're going to tax, you may at the same time have some adverse, incentive effects. You may, for example, have a disincentive of investment. So there's all kinds of trade-offs which are not very nice, obviously that comes from the rule, but that is, at the end of the day, I think it seems that the government is entertaining the possibility of actually taxing as opposed to transferring resources to the EU. Now, just one final point is that, and I think that's also motivational to all of us here in this room and outside this room as well, how important it is to have evidence, to provide evidence-based studies, rigorous studies from a conceptual and also from an empirical standpoint, and having the structured discussion of governments, because governments are increasingly paying attention to that, as opposed to making decisions on the basis of intuition, quote unquote, or hearsay, or something that was done 20 years ago, so let's just repeat it. So I think economists and non-economists, of course, have an extremely important role to play on this development game.
Thanks very much, Claudia. Bashak, I'd like to now turn to you and maybe put you on the spot a bit. The IFC is a big player internationally. It's crucial in mobilizing private sector investment, particularly in emerging markets in more difficult contexts, but also as a project developer that can feed into voluntary carbon markets. I wonder if you could tell us what specific innovations or mechanisms or platforms are needed to enhance the effectiveness and transparencies of these markets, and what concrete actions IFC can take to help address these.
Thank you. Thank you so much, first of all, it's, for your kind invitation. It's so nice to be here. It reminded me my uni days. Basically, as you know, IFC is part of the World Bank Group, and together we work together with IBRD, MIGA, other parts of the World Bank Group, to scale up the carbon markets. Because as a World Bank Group, we firmly believe that the voluntary carbon markets and the Article 6 carbon markets, the Paris Agreement, both of them, are basically, if done correctly, can be transformative for the developing countries and can be very efficient tools to direct the climate finance, to channel the climate finance towards developing countries. So we are a firm believer as a group in carbon markets. So there are a couple of things that we are doing as a World Bank Group, then as an IFC. So World Bank Group, I don't know if you... any of you has seen, has published a carbon markets engagement roadmap last year at COP28. It's a very good document. I would advise you to read it. Basically, what we explain there are a couple of steps that we are taking to scale up the carbon markets. The first one is we are helping, the World Bank Group is helping the countries, developing countries, to kind of implement carbon projects. One of the big programs is FCPF, the Forest Conservation Program of World Bank. We are working with countries like Vietnam, Indonesia, to do an audit, end-to-end audit, to make sure that there is no deforestation here and but there is deforestation there. So the whole country is a jurisdictional base, so it covers the whole country, and that the country can protect its forest and generate carbon credits and be paid to protect their forest. So that's one of the things that the World Bank Group is doing. The second one is we are implementing large-scale programs, like the one of the recent ones is ASCEND. It's basically to bring energy into several African countries and ensure the energy transition to clean energy resources. There are also programs for mangrove plantation, soil carbon, etc. So we are trying to implement large-scale programs that have greenhouse gas abatement and that will have result-based payment mechanisms. And finally, we are working with the carbon market players, the private sector, the registries, the carbon project developers, the principal setters. There are integrity initiatives on the market that we can detail. We are working with all of these players to increase the transparency, to increase the integrity in the market, and then make sure the market is working properly so that the money, the climate, the carbon finance can be channeled towards developing countries. As IFC, so I am working as the carbon finance lead for IFC. What our kind of ambition is to help private sector in developing countries to develop these projects. So if you develop a project in a country, there are corporates, as Rohini was explaining, who buy these credits, like the likes of Microsoft, Google, but they are in general paying at delivery. So once the credits are generated, once the project is implemented, the credits are issued, then they are paying and receiving these credits and they are paying. What we are hoping to help is the upfront payment. So project to have a kickstart, they need the money, for a reforestation project, they need the money to buy the seedlings, to build up the nurseries. And I mean, these are large scale, for instance, reforestation projects or mangrove, to buy the to actually plant the mangrove. So they need the initial money. So the IFC is basically providing the upfront funding that is necessary for these projects to be implemented. The second thing that we are trying to do is to kind of raise the bar in terms of standards, you know. So there are issues in the market. I think the market is an excellent tool. Basically, it is a private sector crowdfunding for carbon projects. But because it's voluntary, because it's unregulated, there are problems of integrity that we have, spoken on both sides, on the supply side, on the project side, and on the demand side, and the corporates who are buying. So what we are hoping to do with our, you know, increased standards, that what we say, we can only support projects, you know, that have high impact, high integrity on the project side, but also that have buyers with net zero targets that will use these credits in line with their net zero path, in line with their decarbonization path, but not for speculative purposes or not, you know, for greenwashing and so on. So as I said, our aim is to build capacity, provide upfront funding, and also to raise the bar in terms of standards by working with the carbon market initiatives. You know, there are initiatives, integrity initiatives on both sides, on the both demand and supply side. For the projects that we are supporting, we want to make sure that there is high integrity on the supply side, on the project side, and on the demand side, on the buyer side.
Great. Thanks. Can I just push you a little bit on that? So seems like we have an opportunity for a real step change now with the Googles and Microsofts and Amazons and whatever coming in on the buy side, and particularly with all the AI-related carbon emissions they're now creating. And yet, it doesn't seem like the market is poised to take off. It seems like there's still very serious issues along the lines that Rohini has made clear. So all of what you describe sounds very good, but I just wonder whether it's actually enough to engineer the step change that we need now, and if not, what more can IFC do?
It's getting better every day, I would say, in the market, because you know, the projects, for instance, the problematic projects that made the news in The Guardian and that caused, you know, the confidence damage to the market, were most of the projects were old projects. You know, they were like the Kariba, for instance, the big project that the New York article, New Yorker article mentioned. These are old projects that are done with old methodologies. So the market is improving every day. So the new methodologies that they are coming with more strict, requirements. There are more eyes on the market. There are rating agents, for instance, now. 2 years ago, there were no rating agencies. So now, at the moment, once you do a project, there are agents like Standards and Poor's type agents like Silvira, B0, Carlisle. There are agents that rate the project, that look at the project numbers, you know, on top of the normal process of, you know, generating these credits. There are kind of rating agencies that rate the projects. There are more eyes on the market, more scrutiny. Hence, it improves basically the project quality. If you look at the new methodologies, new projects, I think the quality is, you know, very different from the old ones. So I think, in a way, it gets better every day. But one thing that the market needs, you know, is trust, basically. So once the buyer buy the project, they need to make sure it's a real reduction or real avoidance or real, you know, removal. And also they need to make sure that it is accepted, you know. So the big problem on the market at the moment is demand side. So the demand, the corporates, they want to be involved. They have these net zero targets. They want to say, okay, you know, I am going to reduce my emissions as much as I can. But for the residual emissions that I cannot reduce, or for scope 3 emissions that I have very little control of, I, you know, can use these credits, basically. However, you know, they are accused. You know, they are accused of greenwashing. They don't know how, when, why to use these credits. So the use case is not very clear. And I think that's one of the biggest problems on the market. And what we are, again, trying to do is to work with the market players, to work with corporates, to make sure that they are, basically, they can use these credits within certain limits, in line with their net zero targets, in line with their decarbonization pledges, and not instead of, you know, it's in addition to their own efforts. And then, you know, that we would like to support. The couple of things that the countries can do together is to clarify this use case. For instance, there are countries like Singapore. Singapore brought a tax to all the corporates, And then if up to 5% of your tax, of your emissions, you can buy voluntary carbon market credits. So that provides a use case for corporates in Singapore to use these, you know, voluntary credits. And they say, okay, I'm going to pay my tax. Up to 5%, I can use the voluntary carbon market within certain conditions. Again, there are conditions that Singapore impose, which is normal. So if we can create, if the countries can create these kind of semi-compliance markets, you know, that you have Chile, Colombia, similar examples in South Africa, so then you accept a portion of voluntary credits, that would be very useful for the, I think, for the market. And also in terms of the property rights as well. So once you buy these credits, you need to make sure you have a legal title of the credits. So that's very important. I think that the private sector, public, or, you know, corporation, collaboration to define the legal property rights of these credits to make sure that they are accepted, they are valid, and they can be exported as well.
Right. Okay, let's. I want to bring Rohini in. Can we stick with this question of how do we achieve a step change now of voluntary carbon markets? And I wonder if you could just sort of reflecting a bit on what we've heard now, and especially just now from Bashak, if you could sort of share what you think are the most important next steps in achieving a step change.
So I think it's super interesting to hear about it. I think one thing I'd push a bit on this idea that the quality is improving every day is you can have the quality improving and shrinking, right? So you would think that part of what you want to be doing is taking, say, a country like Pakistan that says they're interested in this but are very far from the frontier of being able to implement it, is to really think about what is it that can be given as very transparent standards in order to ask them to ask them or ask any project there to achieve against. Right now, at least, and you know, I'm still learning a lot about this market, what I see very often is stated principles, but not actually in some ways sort of falsifiable notions of if you did X, you would be out of the market, or if you did Y, this would be the minimum price. There's still a lot of the case that a lot of the price setting, for instance, happens on these over-the-counter trades between, you know, between two people. There's very limited transparency. So one thing yesterday we were talking to the head of the UK climate change, and you know, he was talking about how for companies, you know, financial regulators can play a role in putting requirements on it. And so I think right now there's still a case in which you know, there's a sense in which of saying, oh, things are improving, or there's no more measurement or more trust, but it's very opaque. What I see right now is a lot of principles. So if you think of ICBCM, one of the big players, it's purely principles. And I think, again, drawing the contrast with CBAM is interesting, because I think CBAM, you know, it has built on, I think, a lot of thinking about how we think trade works, how economics works, exactly these ideas that you were talking about, which are very interesting, that, you know, beyond the point, even the incentive of Mozambique to use that domestic tax and get to it. I think the voluntary carbon market, you know, still relies a little bit on saying, trust us, we will do better, rather than saying there was a problem. It's not just that the projects were old. It was, there are clear issues, for instance, in how verifiers and auditors are being paid. And so we need the regulator, someone to come in and say they can't be paid this way anymore. And perhaps that's happening in the background, but certainly we're not seeing statements saying that, you know, you cannot have the verifier being paid by the project developer. So, I mean, that would be my reflection, that if countries like Pakistan have to enter and be successful at it, I think we would need to develop trust in a market that doesn't exist in these countries. I think it's not enough to have principles or say that new projects have better measurement. Those have to just be something that, you know, we can explain, or we can kind of teach in our classrooms and say this is the measurement method. And I've not seen, for instance, a statement of a single method saying this is the method that we use, unlike, say, a CBAM tax, where it's very clear how that functions.
Thanks. Wonder, now just changing a little bit the focus, Ambassador, coming to you, one of the challenges in developing countries is aligning their climate strategies with their development strategies. And I wonder if you could just say something about that. So what do we need both, you know, internationally but also domestically to get the alignment we need between the climate strategies and development strategies?
Well, for us, and particularly in the context of Pakistan and other countries which are adversely affected by environment, it's critical that our development strategies are aligned. Some areas where we are constrained, such as in energy and which is actually one of the largest contributors, followed by transportation and then agriculture. In all three areas, the government, and as you've mentioned, that the governments are very focused now, looking at what the environmental impacts are. I'll just take the example of agriculture, because that absorbs a large number of population in the country. It contributes roughly 21% to the GDP. So agriculture plays a very critical role. Unless we have agriculture which is sustainable, our per acre yield will go down. We are facing a very unpredictable environment, and we have seen the impact of that. In a year, we have a bumper crop of a particularly important foodstuff. The very next year, the crop is ruined, and we have to rely on imports. So from our perspective, it is critical that we look at both of them together. Now, in order to do so, we again get into an issue of having access to right kind of financing first, having access to environmentally sound technologies, something that we discuss at WTO at length, but have not been able to agree that how those technologies will be transferred, despite the fact that the Paris Agreement clearly says that developing member parties would have access to these technologies and new developments. Access to, let's say, climate-resistant seed, better use of fertilizers, chemicals, better access of technologies which ensures optimal use of water. Because in case of countries like Pakistan, that's one of the impact of environment is actually on water. So we cannot divorce the two. That's from our perspective is absolutely clear, just looking from one particular perspective of agriculture. And we are working towards it. From whatever resources we have, agriculture is a provincial subject. And having worked at the province in Punjab, which is the largest province, we actually had substantial amount of development funding allocated for projects which focused on agriculture and sustainable agriculture. So we'll continue to do that. But whatever commitments there are globally, I think it's important. And it's also important not to bring in extraterritorial features such as CBAM or deforestation or waste regulations, which are not actually in compliance with the WTO rulebook. So if we want the global order to function smoothly, everybody has to live by the rulebook and not use these measures which are actually disguised protection for the local industry.
Thanks. And I'd like to open up the floor to all of you and to our online audience to ask any questions. I'll take them in threes. So very happy now to take any questions. Oh, there are roving mics, so please wait for the mic. When you do, so we'll come to you. When you do ask your question, just I'd ask two things. One, please give us your name and affiliation. And then two, please keep your question short and keep it a question, not a statement, and so we can get the discussion going. So there's someone here in the front first. Right here in the purple. Yeah.
Hi. Hi. My name is Abhishek. I'm from India. So I had a very interesting question on the alignment of development and climate policy. So now, recently, there's a lot of discussion on how public health and climate policy needs to go hand in hand beyond the aspects of pandemic preparedness as well, even on the point of climate carbon mitigation. So when it comes to the private sector that is heavily invested in the health domain, what are the potential strategies that can look at bringing in the private financing in health sector towards climate projects that are achieving goals of both the development as well as climate policy? Because on the development end, health keeps getting more and more expensive. So there's definitely a solution required there. And at the same time, it's going to worsen the climate crisis that we have if there's a low carbon solution is not found to that. So if there's something that panelists would like to share on that.
Great. Thanks very much. Question there with the baseball cap, and then Sorry, and I'll come to you here with the glasses.
Chukwe Mecca, Chikas here. Could the panelists say a little bit about what they think can be some realistic outcomes for COP29 in the context of what has been discussed so far, please?
Great, thanks very much. Yes, and this woman here in the glasses in the fourth row.
Hello, my name is Olivia Stevens. I work for Kivu International. I had a question about sort of voluntary carbon markets and the role of sort of the win-win scenario. Obviously, with a lot of project developers not being from the global south, they're coming from global north countries. And sort of if the emphasis is on the voluntary market, where government has a lot more less interference and therefore a lot more less routes to sort of gain from the benefits of the market, how can it be ensured that those countries that are hosting the projects are actually benefiting? And yeah, what are your thoughts on that issue? Thank you.
Great, thanks very much. Three great questions. So let me, actually, why don't we go backwards? So I'll come to you first on the last on the last one.
So thanks. I think that's a great question about what role should the state play in making that there is that is equitable. I think there's a lot of discussion already about that, but there's a lot of concern that unless the state intervenes, you can have these developers come in and just buy up large areas. I think blue carbon has been sort of talked about this in the context of Africa. So I think there's an important role for states to play. They're thinking about it right now. My understanding is we've seen limited action about, you know, the rules under which you can actually have a project. So what kind of, say, community approval that you need to have for actually a country to be able to be a project owner. And this can come both at the level of the state, but it can also come, I would say, from the, you know, the rating agencies, the regulators and others to place requirements of what we think is equitable. A second part, of course, is how are the resources that are coming in going to make its way to others. So for instance, there's very limited discussion right now on the kind of taxation model around these projects. So for instance, if I'm a landowner, I might sell my land for a project, but that doesn't account for the community that's losing wages or for instance, other forms of taxes that that land was. So again, I think a state can come in and decide to put in place a tax policy to use. Very similar to, I think, how we're thinking, how CBAM is thinking about it, right? So in the ideal world, what happens with CBAM is Mozambique has a tax, collects the revenue and then uses that to, say, subsidize improvements in how aluminium is made in the country to make it more green. Similarly, I think in these kind of projects, we need to start thinking about how exactly are those returns to projects going to be, say, taxed or distributed to communities. And ultimately, I think one way to think about this is voluntary carbon market doesn't mean an unregulated market, especially on things like the transfers that are happening across countries. So I think it's a great question and something we need to push more to see happening. I think some discussions happening already around these issues, I think especially in countries like Brazil, where there's been a lot of it going on in the context of the Amazon.
Great. Thanks, Rahini. Abhishek, I wonder if I could ask you to take on the public health question. So the questions you remember, the first one was this alignment, how do we get alignment between climate change and public health, and in particular, given the need for investment, for especially private investment in the health sector?
Yeah, public health is not my area, first of all. But I think like what the World Bank, I don't know if you have listened to any speeches of Ajay Banga, the president of the World Bank, what he emphasizes quite a lot, and which is true, is these are all intertwined challenges. You know, like now we are unable to distinguish between climate, development, health, you know, carbon reduction. They are all very intertwined, and then the response should also be a collaboration of, you know, different, you know, the public sector, the governments, the private sector, the NGOs, the academia. You know, like, so the challenges are so huge and so interconnected. I think we should all work together. So I don't know like specific public health policies that we need for climate, but a very simple example, like, you know, the hospitals, the need for cooling, you know, the air condition and so on, these kind of stuff are all very interconnected. So when we do support projects for instance, buildings, you know, the green buildings, IFC has a large green building program. EDGE certificate. So when we try to kind of make the new buildings in a more greener way, in a more climate friendly or low carbon way, or, you know, again, make the existing building, retrofit the existing buildings, being hospitals or other kind of public buildings, in a more kind of low carbon and more environmentally friendly, climate adapted way, the better it is. But in terms of public health policies, or I'm not the right person to reply, but I think the challenges are very interconnected, so everything is some.
I mean, one thing I would add is, of course, air pollution is a great area in which there's alignment between these policies, right? Because, you know, it's hugely important. I mean, developing country cities have very, very high pollution levels, we've now learned. And you know, in many cases, measures that will reduce carbon can also reduce air pollution. And actually, Rohini's done some really interesting work about how we can use market solutions to drive down pollution as well. So there's that's worth looking into. Taking the third question about COP, what are the realistic expectations be about COP?
Which one, the upcoming one?
Yeah, the upcoming one.
Well, what we are hoping, and that it should be able to resolve some of the issues. First, around the loss and damage fund, that would be ideal. If you look at L&D fund, it's a 26-member board. If you look at the minutes of the last meeting, it's still coming up with the budgets and probably going to spend 16% of his budget on administrative affairs before actually money flows into our project, with the total commitments being $670 million, whereas the requirement is the commitment has to be around $100 billion per year. So very little fund, but still not capitalized. You try to find on the internet how much it has been capitalized, you will find it very difficult to do so. I tried ChatGPT, it didn't answer me, said it's contentious. The second thing is we definitely need standards and global cooperation. The issue really is climate is a global challenge. It's a challenge for all of us. It's actually a mess created by our generation for this generation, right, unfortunately. And that requires a functioning global market to which all governments sign up. Now, that's very difficult and tough one to achieve. I don't know if there could be steps taken towards it in that particular direction, where it could be a global trading system for carbon markets and carbon offsets, where there's a reliability of the system which is supported by very reliable audits and auditors. That would be fantastic. Although I have my serious doubts it would happen. But if that happens, that would be fantastic.
May I just compliment?
Yep.
I think this discussion is quite interesting. But at the end of the day, we're discussing financing. And we know so far is a bit of a trickle. And if you look at financing, I think we can divide this in two ways. One, market-based mechanisms, and I think then goes back to Rohini's point, is that maybe the pricing is right and even the object is not there. When you talk about, you know, paying for environmental services, it's not there yet. And then when you talk about no market mechanisms, funds, the recent discussions of the Minister of Finance in G20, they came to the conclusion, which I think is fairly obvious, but important that they say it, the green funds are highly bureaucratic, and at the end of the day, they don't get the resources where they should at. So in a sense, here we have the following conundrum. There has to be a step change or a multiple step change, but on the one hand, the funds that could be directed to the countries which are in need are very bureaucratic, huge obstacles on the one hand. The markets face the obstacles that Rohini pointed out, in particular the pricing, I think, is still very far from what is needed. So we have to act, I guess, on both, on both dimensions.
More questions? Okay, so if you gentlemen at the very back. Oh, good idea. Okay, and here at the top. So, first, then, thanks.
Thank you very much for your inputs. I would be interested. It's not on? Thank you very much now for your input. I would be interested in your perspective on how to bring together the construction of the global carbon market.
So can you speak a bit louder?
Yes, yeah.
We can't hear.
So how to bring together a global carbon market with the idea of common but differentiated responsibilities to mitigate climate change, and then what role for innovative market solutions in financing adaptation?
Sorry, it's very difficult to hear. Could you restate, talking a bit louder, right into the microphone so we can hear?
Yes, of course. So what is your perspective on bringing together this construction of a global united carbon market with the principle of common but differentiated market responsibilities for mitigating climate change, and then the role of market solutions for financing climate adaptation?
Great. Okay. Then up there.
Andy, LSE. My question is about for countries that are like low-income countries that require that needs deforestation to generate more income. How can carbon financial instrument and mechanism to balance this development and carbon emission reduction? Thank you.
Thanks. And I have one question from our online audience, which is, what are the key points to be considered to regulate carbon markets? So. Do you want to start with this, the question about how we bring together the voluntary carbon markets?
Yeah, no, thanks. So I think in some ways this is a little further out, because the most important thing we need to do right now is to, I think, address some of the quality issues in terms of credits. But ideally what you want is you want these carbon offsets or carbon projects to be entering compliance markets. Because once you enter a compliance market, you enter a market that has an emission cap. And if you actually succeed, and again, this is quite far out, to have some kind of global or multi-country compliance market, you can adjust, use your emission caps and the giving of permits in order to get to this idea of differentiated responsibility. Right? So in the end, you will probably want an industry in the global north to be a net negative holder of permits in that market. And you know, someone in the global south will get a lot more permits at, say, the start in order to account to the fact that they need space to develop. But you know, we have many steps to get there, but I think that would be the aim, that I think you're going to need compliance markets in order to be able to use then permits, allocation of permits, to be able to address this issue of differentiated pricing or differentiated compensation.
The second question is also naturally coming to you around the deforestation there. Do you want to say something? I don't know if anyone else would like to add. So,
On the deforestation, so the current voluntary market has the RED scheme for generating income to protect the forests. As I said, the World Bank has its own programs and the carbon markets. It had its problem. One of the big problem was the additionality and the baseline. You know, like, so you assume a certain assumption in the future. If I haven't protected this forest, it would have been destroyed. So how do you, you know, how do you make sure that your assumption is correct? You know, maybe it wouldn't have been destroyed and so on. So that was the big debate basically on the RED. But now again, the current methodologies are more focused on jurisdictional. So it is basically across the whole country. So you cannot defrost. You know, you avoid the leakage within the country, and also the baselines will be fixed across the country by VERA, by one of the registries. So I think with the new, hopefully the new methodologies, it will be easier to generate carbon credits out of these red projects. The one thing I have for us is Rohini was saying, that there is a lot of emphasis at the moment on carbon removal projects, that you know, that you actually remove the CO2. But if you think it as a swimming pool, you know, it's if you put a red dye in the pool, it's easier to not to put the red dye instead of like try to remove the red dye from the pool. So it's much easier and much more cost effective to protect the existing forests than try to reforest or afforest at a large scale. So we should do everything we can, and I think the voluntary carbon mechanisms are perfect for that, to protect the existing forests. There are initiatives like Art Trees, Leaf Coalition, if you can have a look on the internet, that the companies come together and they will be financing the project that protects forests. similar to, as I said, the World Bank FCPF program.
Yes,
sorry.
Can I just add one
thing? Just quick, yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree. But I think specifically on your question, I think some of what you're saying is that we need to think about where you're going to get your livelihood from, if not the forest. And I don't think that's just about setting the price for the forest, right? Because that's a price today, which may be very cheap. But it's actually to ask, you know, what is it in terms of, say, getting this person to a city, into a wage job, in some service sector? What is that cost? And that, in some ways, has to feed into this price here. I think that's a long way off from where we are, but I think we should be starting to have those discussions, because otherwise the price is going to be too low.
I read a study for Amazon at $20 per ton. You can actually compete with cattle ranching, for instance. You know, if you pay $20, it will be more beneficial to protect the forest. And so on. And if you think of the cost, it's much better.
Yeah. Sorry, we're at time now. So with apologies to the online question about regulating carbon markets, I think we've answered your question in the course of the different discussions. The points about standards, about transparency, about the role of governments are all very much part of the answer today. So it just remains to me to thank all of you for coming. I think we've had a very provocative and informative discussion and great questions from all the audience. So I hope you'll join me in thanking our speakers.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.